Greetings all, and welcome to the teleclass, Certification in Infection Control, Don't Make It Harder Than It Has to Be. My name is Paul Weber, and I am really pleased that you've made this time to spend with us. For several hundred of you, this will be your first teleclass experience with us anyway, and I know that it will be time very well spent. Now, until last week, I didn't know about Sylvia Garcia Hutchins, but when I consulted some very smart people about the best possible speaker for this topic, Sylvia's name kept coming up. And now that I've done my usual research, I can see that she is someone that I should have known all along. Sylvia Garcia Hutchins is the Director of Infection Control at the University of Chicago Medical Center. She is the President-elect of the Chicago APIC chapter. If you do a Google search under her name, you will find some really fascinating articles. And what's important for us is that she has walked several of her colleagues through the process of becoming certified in infection control, and all of them were certified on the first try. So she's very well qualified. It's a real honor to have her with us today, and I'll let her get to it. So
Thank you, Paul.
From the University of Chicago Medical Center, to bring us the teleclass, Certification in Infection Control, Don't Make It Harder Than It Has to Be, I am pleased to present Sylvia Garcia Hutchins. Sylvia.
Thank you, Paul. And just so everybody knows, when Paul called me, I said, boy, most ICPs who are not certified think it's just so much harder than it is, and you just really need to be organized is the important part about it. You should all have in front of you the handouts for this class. So the first thing I want to talk about is why be CIC. You know, this is not usually something that ICPs are required to be, CIC, but there are a lot of reasons to do it. One is that Joint Commission recognizes it. So if any of you have ever been through a Joint Commission survey, they will come in and go through the standards and ask you for proof. And one of the standards is that the program must be being run by a qualified infection control professional. It's also a requirement in many states for mandated state reporting that you be a qualified infection control practitioner. And by having your certification, you can therefore meet the qualification. They will not question your qualifications. More recently, employers are starting to require certification as a minimum qualification. If you go online to some of the sites where they are advertising infection control professional positions, you will see that that has become much more prevalent. When I started in infection control in 1985, it was not the norm to be certified. It wasn't required. Nobody asked you were you certified. Nowadays, they are asking for an RN, an MPH, microbiologist with certification. And sometimes what I've seen in some positions, if they're asking for an RN for the position, if you can come in and say you are certified and certified infection control professional but not an RN, they may be willing to change that job description because you are certified. So it adds that marketability. The other thing it does is it provides a standard measurement of an infection control professional's knowledge. If you are certified in infection control, you have met some basic education in order to pass that test. And it's a two-year experience you have to have before you can do it, and it says something about you as a professional, that you have that basic knowledge that says you are qualified to do your job. It's also important for your individual growth and professionalism. And a lot of people just look at it and think of, this is going to cost me money. You know, how much is it going to cost? I'm not getting reimbursed for it. But when you go to an APIC meeting, a national meeting, or you go to SHEA, or you go somewhere else and you can say, I'm certified in infection control, people look at you differently. They see someone who has cared enough about their profession to become certified in it. Just as many nurses are certified in critical care, it really says that level of professionalism, that you have achieved that level of professionalism and that you care about it. It does enhance your credibility and prestige. I know that when I first became certified, I remember my ID doc, who was the head of my program at the time, I came in and I said, well, I'm certified. I hadn't told him I was going to get certified because I was worried what happens if I don't pass. I went away. We used to have to go to APIC at the national conference to take the certification exam. I went to the conference. I took the exam. I passed. You know, we used to find out in the mail weeks later. And I came in and I said, I'm certified. And he said, yes, yeah, so what? That's not the response anymore. People have become educated about certification in infection control, and there's so many other certifications out there. That's one more important thing about your growth. So how much does it cost to be certified in infection control? Well, I took this right out of the CBIC Candidate Handbook. For first-time certifiers, it's going to cost you $310, and that may seem like a lot of money, but many hospitals are so desperate these days to have qualified infection control professionals that they are willing to reimburse you for that certification. A lot of people, a lot of practitioners say to me, well, I don't get reimbursed for this, or the hospital isn't willing to pay. And what I have found is a lot of professionals aren't asking. Sometimes infection control is under the nursing department, and sometimes it isn't. But if your hospital has any type of reward system for nurses becoming certified, then infection control certification should fall under that. 2 years ago at our hospital, we started rewarding our practitioners. They get a bonus when they become certified, and we pay for the test if they bring in the receipts. We will even pay for them to go to a training class if they feel they need it, which I haven't had anybody take me up on that. So it really comes down to what are you willing to ask for. I went to administration and said, look, this is going to help us with Joint Commission. It's going to stop all the questions. And they did it. If you don't ask, you'll never get it. So please research that at your hospital. Ask when you're up for review. Use it as a marketing tool for yourself. So as far as eligibility to take the certification exam, you have to meet two criteria. The first criteria is your educational background. You must either have a current license or registration certification as a medical technologist, a clinical lab scientist, a physician, or a registered nurse. But do not let that stop you from taking the exam. My background, I have a degree in biochemistry and molecular biology, which is a degree that's considered a microbiology degree. And at the time I took the certification exam, I was worried, does this count? And went through the process, and it did. It did count. It's a bachelor's degree, so it meets the minimum qualification. So if you're worried about your minimum qualifications, let's say you're an LPN or an RN but not a bachelor's degree RN, you should be able to still meet the minimum qualifications so long as you meet the next eligibility requirement, which is for initial certification, you have to have a minimum of 2 years' practice in infection control and within the most current five-year period. So you couldn't have done infection control 15 years ago and now want to get certified. You have to have done it within the last 5 years, and at least 800 of those hours have to be worked prior to the exam. They will have whoever you worked for sign a certificate that says you completed this requirement. This requirement cannot be waived. So I have had practitioners call me, or I actually had a microbiologist who called me who said, I want to be an infection control practitioner, but I can't get my foot in the door because I'm not certified and I'm not a nurse. What do I do? And I said, well, then you got to do the first thing, which is meet that minimum requirement of experience. You've got to get someone to give you a chance. And she was actually willing to work for 2 years as a volunteer to get that experience, which tells me this is someone who really is motivated. She's going to go do everything to get that certification so she can meet the minimum qualifications and therefore get a job. If you truly want to be an infection control professional, this is something I cannot emphasize enough, get the experience. You can work as an intern for some programs. You can work your regular job and volunteer to get some hours. And most programs have a hard time training new practitioners because it's so labor-intensive, but when you show your value, they may hire you and give you this chance to get your job experience. If you already have 2 years of experience, you're already ahead of the game. Somebody's given you that chance. Your activities in infection control, you must must include both analysis and interpretation of the collected infection control data. So it's not enough to go out there and do surveillance. You have to be able to take that surveillance and do something with it. What does it mean? And then you have to have investigation and surveillance of suspected outbreaks of infection. You have to know what the system is in the hospital or in the facility you're working in, because it could be a long-term care facility, it could be home health, but you have to know how are you going to investigate and work up outbreaks of infection. And those are core functions that you must be able to do. Then you also have to meet at least three of those other items listed here. And if you're the manager of an infection control program, if you do part-time quality assurance and part-time infection control, then you're managing infection prevention control activities. If you answer questions of the staff about infection control, then you're providing consultation. So really think about how to maximize what you've already done to meet this qualification. As far as taking the exam, the test is administered through the Assessment Centers, which is Applied Measurement Professionals website. It's goamp.com. I actually took this screenshot straight from goamp.com. And what will happen is you will have to choose a category. You choose healthcare. You will have to choose a program, and you choose Certification Board of Infection Control, CBIC. And then you choose the type of exam, and it will say Certification Infection Control Examination. The test consists of 150 questions. 135 of those questions are scored, and 50 of them are trial test questions. There is also an opportunity when you are taking the exam. If you run into a question and you say, there is no right answer to this question, you have the opportunity at that point to register your concern. And those are included if you're on a situation where it's, you may be borderline pass, that you commented and could say why you thought this was an unfair question may help you. So when you go to GoAMP and you click that last button for the certification exam, you will get this website. And through this website, you can download the candidate handbook. It's for free. It's 28 pages long, and it basically puts you through what you need to do. There is a you can purchase a practice exam depending on where you look. Some places say it's 50 questions, some places say it's 70 questions. You go through a website to take your practice exams. You can locate a test center, and these are very easy to find. Most of them are local H&R Block sites. You go in, you put in your zip code, and it's going to pop up a list of places that are within 25 miles of you. My practitioners have not had a problem finding a place. You go in for the exam. They will ask you for ID. They will monitor you with video while you take the exam. Once you've figured out a test site, you register or you reschedule the exam through this site. This is a copy of the candidate handbook. The candidate handbook could go through GoAMP, or you could go through CBIC.org. Either one of them will get you to the candidate handbook. It's very wordy. You follow the directions, and you get to the end. Now, you should know that CBIC has stated that it is a conflict of interest for CBIC to provide specific test guidance. Now, that all said, they do offer you the chance to do practice exams. They are not actual exam questions that you will find on this exam. There is a pool of test questions that you may get, so not everybody gets exactly the same questions. But it does give you a chance to practice and see the timing and what kind of questions and be prepared from that standpoint. There are several places that you can go on the website. APIC has several that you can take a study guide or a study class. APIC provides a study guide which CBIC wants you to know has not been developed and is not endorsed by CBIC. At the same time, many of the people who contributed to that document, to that study guide, are people who are infection control practitioners actively in practice who may at some time have also worked on the CBIC board. So there is that plus. It's a book done by practitioners who have been certified. The APIC Certification Review Course is not a course developed by CBIC also, but it is also another wonderful place to go to get basic training in infection control. I've actually, instead of sending my practitioners there for certification review, have sent them there as if they're already going to the APIC conference, national conference anyway, I send them for that that certification review course when they're new, because it's a very basic course on this is what you need to know. This presentation, I have to put it in the disclaimer list. It's based on my experience as an infection control professional. I've had 20 years of experience. I am certified, and I have prepared employees to take the CIC exam. And as Paul said, they have all passed on the first try. I think the most difficult thing for someone who's preparing for the certification exam is you start looking at these books on these websites, or you ask another professional, can you borrow their old certification exam booklets, and practitioners start to panic, and they say, oh, my gosh, I can't do this. Well, this is the open book, open note to prepare you for it. The actual test is not as hard as what you will see in these preparation guides. So I can't say that enough. I have a practitioner who literally stalled for about a year and a half. She was so worried about it. Didn't tell me she was taking the exam, went to the H&R Block, took the exam, came back in and said, oh, my God, it was so easy. I was worked up about nothing. The worst thing that happens is you don't pass, you know what you need to study, and you go back. So please try it. Remember that no matter who you are or how smart you are, you must study for this exam. There is basic information. You have to know some basic statistics. You have to know what a median is. You need to know what a mean is. And you need to just be able to answer the questions straight out. That is not something that I, to this day, carry around in my head. Sometimes I have to go and refresh myself. Is this a median or is this a mean? Wait a minute. Have I got my terminology, my statistics terminology right? Everybody has to do that. The expectation is that you will do that before the exam. If you've been practicing infection control for more than 2.5 years, my suggestion is to you, get a study partner, decide on a date for taking the test, and set up your study timeline based on the date. That way you have structure, you know it's going to happen, you've committed yourself, go and register. It makes you do the steps that you need to do. You can't keep putting it off. If you have been a practicing infection control practitioner for 2.5 years, you have the basic knowledge through your day-to-day work to probably answer about 50% of the questions at that point. There are two references that CBIC recommends. Those are the APIC text for infection control and then Control of Communicable Diseases in Man. It's now called the Control of Communicable Disease Manual. These are basic reference that you should have. APIC text, you can't buy it at Amazon.com or any of the other online bookstores. The way you buy it is you go to the APIC website, www.apic.org. You click on the Resources tab, and you go to the APIC store. The cost for non-members is $475 to $545. Don't panic. It seems like a lot of money. This is a reference you will use throughout your career. And we are in the process of updating. I'm an author in that book. We are in the process of updating that text. But you should know that even your old text will always give you the basics unless something radically changes, which it hasn't. From the first time this was published, it has not radically changed. Your statistics is always going to be your statistics. Bundles are always going to be bundles for the central line stuff. It doesn't change that much. So long as you have a version of the APIC text, even if it's the old one, you go to an infection control program at your hospital and you say, do you have an old APIC text that I can study from? They will probably give it to you or lend it to you. This is a basic reference that all infection control programs should have. If you are working in a facility that does not have the APIC text, you need to go to your administrator and say, this is a basic text. I need to do my job. Can we buy this? I can't imagine any administrator who's worth their salt saying, no, you can't have it. It's your basic reference to get your job done. It's also nice if you buy the version with a CD. I've had new practitioners where we print out a chapter and we say, here's a chapter to read this week, and highlight it and put your questions on it, and then we'll go over it at the end of the week. And that way you have something that you can take and read as you go. You don't have to do it all at once. But you can be sitting, you know, waiting for your child outside of their softball game, waiting for them to get in the car and reading for 15 or 20 minutes. What I would recommend that you not do is I've gone online and seen people saying, oh, there's a way to scam the test. You know, you can go in and put in study guides for CBIC, and you will get all these flashcards for doing this. Read the text. It has the information you need. And don't read for memorization. Read for basic knowledge. So do you have to read the entire text? In my opinion, no. Remember, the CIC exam is a test for basic knowledge that an ICP should have with 2 years of experience. Volume 1 is your essential elements. You need to read all of Volume 1. And again, the easiest way to do it is break it up. Break it up into manageable sections, you know, a chapter a night, a chapter every 2 nights if you're not a fast reader. Share it among a study group. Everybody takes, you know, a chapter and then highlights the important parts and does study notes for everybody. That's the fastest, easiest way to get prepared for this test. Other parts of the APIC text, Volume 1, Scientific and Practice Elements, I think you need to read the whole thing. Advanced Program Management, that's where you're going to find out about FTEs and what you have to have as far as occupational health. I believe you need to read all of that. In Section 7, it focuses on patient population. There's a lot more than the three I've listed. This is for your average infection control practitioner. Some of the hospitals won't have the other specialty units. They're not going to test those specialty units. Neonatal is going to cover your very young infants, pediatrics, and geriatrics. Those are your basic patient populations that most infection control practitioners will need to know. As far as practice settings, my experience is I wrote the dialysis chapter. They usually ask a question that's a very basic question about dialysis. It's what's the panic level for counts of CFUs per milliliter of processed water? That's a basic question that every practitioner should know the answer to. 200 CFUs per ml, that's when you start doing things you may not be able to dialyze at that point, or even that cultures need to be done on a monthly basis. That's the kind of information they're looking for. I added endoscopy to the list of APIC text items to focus on because I think it's becoming a much more important area to infection control practitioners. It's becoming the mode which doctors are using to diagnose, much less invasive, and there's a lot of infection control pitfalls on it. So I think you need to know endoscopy very well. Behavioral health, as we branch out and have more infection control practice in unusual settings. Behavior health is one that has grown recently. And because the test was updated in 2006, I think you will see some behavioral health questions. Other sections of the APIC text, Section 10, Organisms and Presentations, Bacteria, you need to know your basic bacteria. Do you need to know the name of every bacteria? No. You need to know E. coli. You need to know strep pneumo. You need to know staph aureus. Do you need to know where they live? For the basic organisms, yes. You need to know that E. coli lives in the GI tract. You need to know that VRE lives in the GI tract. For viruses, you need to know certain viruses, the ones I would consider important, influenza, because there will probably be information questions about influenza because it's been a focus. Other viruses, herpes, zoster and herpes simplex. CMV is a good question about occupational health and medicine. And then other pathogens, Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, prion disease, is one that we know is an issue from an infection control standpoint. You can probably guess there's going to be at least one question about prion disease because of the management of instruments that they become contaminated with blood or spinal fluid. As far as clinical syndromes, I would focus in on skin and soft tissue infections because of MRSA and how much that has increased in the last few years. Food-related illnesses, they want to know that you are able to work up an outbreak of food-related illness or diarrheal illness in your facility. The questions that I have seen in the past are usually questions where they give you you have four staff members who have called in sick with diarrhea. They all developed diarrhea within 12, they all worked the same shift, and 12 hours after leaving, they had explosive diarrhea. They're going to ask you what organism is associated with a 12-hour incubation period and explosive diarrhea. That's the kind of question you need to be able to answer. And if you read these sections, you will be fine. As far as the care environment, this is where you're going to find linen and laundry services, ventilation systems, renovation and construction. These are the basic elements of the care environment that every practitioner needs to know, whether you're taking the CIC exam or not. Advanced occupational health is really, you need to know your vaccine-preventable diseases. You need to know when do you need to pull out all the stops to do an exposure workup of your staff. And then local and international community, under that I would focus in on your public health, your disaster management, and your bioterrorism, not in detail, in basics. Because of what happened with anthrax, everybody should probably know anthrax and what the symptoms are of anthrax and what you do for anthrax. As far as disaster management, that you have to have a disaster management plan, that you have to have a plan for influx of patients. And as far as public health, what are the basic things you need to be doing to monitor public health in your institution, and then how do you liaison with your public health facility? What's the appropriate things to do? With Control of Communicable Diseases Manual, it's a cheap book. I can't say it enough. This is one that my new practitioners, I give them one walking in the door. This is your copy. It's yours for life. If you leave here, you take it with you. It's $33. You can buy it cheaper online. I think I've found them as low as like $22, $23, depending on what website you go on. You can go to most bookstores nowadays and find Control of Communicable Diseases in Man. In my opinion, it's not essential to have the most recent edition, so if you have an old edition, great. This is the book that when you get a call, you know, from a resident on a Saturday morning, this is the book that I go to and say, oh, you want to ask me about parainfluenza or you want to ask me about parvovirus? I go in there and I can look up the basics about that disease and be able to answer the questions. It really is a book that every infection control practitioner should have their own. As far as control of communicable diseases in man, and I keep saying in man because that used to be its title, manual, I would recommend that you focus on the common things. Chickenpox and herpes zoster. What are the differences? What do you do as far as exposures? Who's considered susceptible? Who's considered immune? With diarrhea, what are the acute causes of diarrhea? And then E. coli 0157, because that is a foodborne illness that happens. You need to know about foodborne intoxications, that staph toxin. How are you going to know that this patient or staff member was exposed to the toxin from Staph aureus rather than an actual staph infection? Gastroenteritis is going to help you with your foodborne illness and your cross-transmission in hospitals. All of the viral hepatitises. You should know the incubation period for hepatitis A and how it's transmitted, fecal-oral route. Hepatitis B, how it's transmitted. And then hepatitis C, how it's transmitted. You may also need to know what the risk is for an occupational exposure. With influenza, how do you prevent it? Who gets vaccinated? How is it transmitted? What's the incubation period? Meningitis, I would focus in on meningococcal meningitis, because that is the one where you would have to prophylax staff if they had intimate respiratory contact. That is the one that is so important to report immediately to your public health department so they can follow up on exposed contacts. That one, my guess is you will see a question on. Other part that a lot of people don't know is that you also have to work on prophylaxis for your exposed lab personnel in the microbiology lab, who work with the actual culture, and you need to know that there is a vaccine available for meningococcal meningitis. With mumps, we're not seeing a lot of mumps these days, but they still are focusing on the basic childhood illnesses, so making sure that should we have an outbreak, practitioners know how to recognize them and what the immediate control steps are. So you've got mumps, measles are the two ones that you should know. pediculosis lice. How do you handle lice, and what do you have to do for it? And, you know, staff's reaction to lice is usually, oh my gosh, we've got, you know, that patient has lice, I'm sure I've got it. And it's really focused on standard precautions and contact isolation if you need it for someone who's you're going to hold up against your body. What are the control measures for lice? That's what you really need to know about it. For pertussis, you need to know about prophylaxis of employees. You need to know that even if they were immunized, that they are still capable of developing pertussis, that there is not good data yet out about the ability to protect employees as far as transmission. So it is still recommended that they get prophylaxis. What that prophylaxis is. So it's Z-Pak, it's azithromycin. And you may also need to know, for example, for meningococcal meningitis, the old prophylaxis was rifampin, but now it's Cipro, one dose of Cipro. There may be a question about what the prophylaxis is and choose what the best prophylaxis is and why. With smallpox, they're going to want you to know the difference between chickenpox and smallpox and the presentation of it and what you need to be worried about the vaccine, i.e., you can that person, if they get vaccinated, could give somebody else vaccination. There could be auto-inoculation. Staphylococcal and streptococcal disease remains the basics for all infection control practitioners. You need to know what the symptoms are for staphylococcal disease, how it's diagnosed, what kind of cultures they do, what about you need to know probably about VISA, vancomycin intermediate staph aureus. You need to know about MRSA. With streptococcal disease, group A strep is a deadly disease. It can rapidly kill in 12 hours if you're having an outbreak in your OR, for example. You could have deaths very quickly. They're going to focus on streptococcal disease, not from a, oh, they have a strep throat, but more of the advanced disease process, peritonsillar abscesses, scarlet fever, and what precautions you take to prevent those, or what would you do if you had a patient with group A strep who just had surgery? How would you follow up as a possible outbreak? Syphilis, and then, of course, TB. What are the control measures for TB? How often do people have to have a PBD skin test? I would read something about QuantiFERON gold, since that has been emerging in use at different hospitals. It is a simple blood test that can be done that can show previous infection with TB, what a two-step PPD is and why you do a two-step PPD, and then what the recommendation is if you have a PPD conversion. Other resources, CPIC has developed a practice exam. Again, I said it's available through the CPIC website. It's 50 to 70 retired questions that were previously used on the certification exam. These are the basic questions. These are the ones that are really not going to change, but give you an idea of content that you need to make sure you focus on. It gives you familiarity with the type and the complexity of the questions that you're going to get on the certification exam. And it also helps you go through that computer technology. I recently took my nursing boards, and I was surprised it wasn't what I learned in nursing school. It was really, could I use the computer technology to answer the questions, and how was the question phrased? And much less specific knowledge on a topic, but how to apply it. You can use the APIC Certification Study Guide. I believe the most recent edition is 2007. It's available at the same link as the APIC text. It's a basic outline of what you need to study. In my opinion, you can use the certification guide as your study guide, but you still need to go through that APIC text if you want to be secure before you take the exam. There are old self-assessment recertification exams. If you ask, and I don't know how kosher this is, but if you ask ICPs who are already certified, who need to be recertified, part of the recertification exam is a booklet that they send you, and it's called the SAR, and you answer the questions, and the old way you used to answer the questions, and then send in your SAR for grading, and they sent you back the answers and your scores. If you know any certified infection control practitioners, I can bet dollars to donuts they have those old copies. That test is much harder than the CIC exam, the basic CIC exam, much harder. if you can answer, I would say 70% of those questions, even just looking up the answers, you are ready for the certification exam. As far as test specifics, you will find them on the CBIC website. There is a list of different areas that will be tested, and under each of those areas is a sample of what you need to know about each of those sections. So, for example, for identification of infectious disease processes, there are a total of 27 questions, and they give you A through M on what you need to know, the basics of what you need to know. The important thing to remember is, even though they've given you that roadmap, those exam questions will take those concepts and apply them. It is not enough to know the basic terminology. So in the next set of slides, I'm on slide 25, for example, at the beginning of this, the very first thing they tell you under identification of infectious disease processes is that you must differentiate between colonization, infection, and contamination. And I've given you the definitions, and I pulled those straight out of the APIC text. It is not enough for you to memorize this. You have to be able to apply it. And so how do you apply it? So this is a possible test question. A patient has an increased temperature with no other symptoms, and the physician orders urine, blood, and endotracheal aspirate cultures. The results are as follow. Urine has 10 to the 4th colony-forming units per ml E. coli. Blood is no growth. Endotracheal aspirate is many Staph aureus, few E. coli, few Acinetobacter, and the Gram stain has no white blood cell counts. Based on these results, this patient most likely has. And before I even answer them, what do these results mean? Well, from your reading about urinary tract infections, you should know that 10 to the 4th CFU per ml is not indicative of an infection, of a urinary tract infection. And that E. coli, even though E. coli commonly causes UTIs, so that's a stumper. The blood is no growth. Nothing grew. So increased temperature, but blood is no growth. Can't have a bloodstream infection. Endotracheal aspirate is growing organisms. Has many Staph aureus, few E. coli, and few Acinetobacter. If an ICP guest sees, a lot of times they'll say, but the endotracheal tube aspirate is growing. That is not a sterilely obtained culture. It has to go through the mouth and the respiratory tract to come out. So it can become contaminated with mouth flora or other organisms in the respiratory tract. The important part about that one is that the Gram stain has no white blood cells. White blood cells are indicative of pus. There's no pus here. There's nothing to indicate there's an infection here other than organisms. So your choices are that this patient has a respiratory infection with Staph aureus, E. coli, and Acinetobacter. There's nothing in here possible test question that says anything about the patient's having symptoms consistent with pneumonia, and that he has purulent sputum. So this is not a respiratory infection. This patient has respiratory colonization with Acinetobacter. Yeah. He's growing Acinetobacter in his respiratory tract. We have no reason to believe he's infected. That is true. So B is the answer. He has a urinary tract infection caused by E. coli. We already went over that. Less than 10 to the 4th, he can't have that. Respiratory infection with Staph aureus, even though that is the predominant organism and it's many Staph aureus, doesn't meet the purulent sputum requirement, so therefore not a respiratory infection. So the next item that you need to know for identification of the infectious disease process is you're going to need to know how to interpret a Gram stain and a microbiology culture result. And I did this on a Saturday afternoon. What are the basics? From a Gram stain standpoint, you need to know, is it a Gram positive or a Gram negative? And if it's a Gram positive, is it a Gram positive cocci or is it a Gram positive bacilli? And from that, you need to be able to say, oh, the question's asking me about a Gram positive cocci. Is it in clusters or in chains? And they will probably give you that information. If it's in clusters, I should be thinking staph. If it's chains, I should be thinking strep. And then here's the basic organisms that could be under there. If it's a gram-positive bacilli, you're going to look at what the question talks about. And, you know, it may be a patient presents to the ER. He has symptoms of A, B, C, and D. And, gee, those sound like anthrax symptoms. And his blood culture is identified as growing gram-positive bacilli, they're going to ask you to identify, could this be a Bacillus anthracis? However, patient comes into the ER, has an increased temperature, no other localizing symptoms, and he grows gram-positive bacilli and a gram-negative bacilli in the same culture. What is the most likely source of this patient's infection? In this case, it may be a bacillus species that's a contaminant. So you need to be able to differentiate the two. So here's another possible test question. Patient suspected of having meningitis and has a spinal fluid obtained for gram stain and culture. Gram stain shows rare white blood cells and many gram-positive cocci pairs. The most likely cause of this patient's meningitis is, remember, he's got white blood cells in his spinal fluid, and even though it's rare, he's got a gram stain that's got white blood cells, and he's got organism in his gram stain. You cannot say this is contaminant. You automatically got to start thinking, what's a gram-positive cocci in pairs? This is where you say, gram-positive cocci in pairs, is it a gram-positive that somebody over-decolorized? Is this a gram-negative? Gram-negative difficult cocci, you're thinking Neisseria meningitis. Gram-positive cocci in pairs should be a strep. Strep pneumoniae is your most likely choice. E. coli would be a gram-negative bacilli. Staph aureus would be gram-positive cocci in clusters. So you have to be able to go through that process of what is this most likely. Other issues that are brought, and I'm really going to focus on this first section, which is identification of infectious disease processes. Remember that you need to know information about immunity to infectious diseases. And there are five major types of antibodies. I'm focusing on the top four because the fifth kind, nobody knows much about. So IgA are antibodies that protect your body surfaces when they're exposed to a foreign substance. IgG and IgM are really the ones you need to know. When you are exposed to, for example, chickenpox, and your body starts having its immune response, the first thing your body is going to make, if you haven't previously been exposed and infected, your body is going to make IgM. That's the first type of antibody that's made in response to an infection. After IgM goes up and is starting to go down, IgG is the type of antibody that confers immunity. It's also the type of antibody that crosses the placenta. And this is important to know because you might get a question that says, you know, the mom was exposed to chickenpox. Is her baby at risk? Well, has mom had chickenpox? So you need to know that next part of the question. So in this case, a possible test question is, an employee indicates that he has been exposed to chickenpox 14 days ago. The presence of which of the following antibodies would indicate immunity? Well, IgM is what you get if you've been exposed and become infected recently. IgG is your long-term immunity. So let's put a different twist on this. Employee comes in and says he's been exposed to chickenpox 14 days ago, and he has a rash. Now you're saying, oh great, he's got a rash, he must have chickenpox. The presence of which antibody would indicate immunity? Well, at that point, he's already got a rash. Could he start to develop IgG? Yes. So it's not enough to say, IgG versus IgM, maybe he's got both. So in this case, if you got a question like that and you had trouble differentiating between the two, you can go up to your place where you can put in comments on the computer when you're taking the test, and you could put, this does not make sense to me because this patient has a rash. He could have IgM and IgG at this point if he's an early responder. So that's your time to question the question. This other things that you need to be able to differentiate is you need to be able to differentiate between prophylactic antibiotic therapy, empiric antibiotic therapy, and therapeutic antibiotic therapy. And these are terms that are being used a lot with the surgical improvement project that's been going on, the SCIP measures. You need to be able to know the difference and explain the differences to people. And so for that one, I give you another question. Patient undergoes a total knee arthroplasty and is given a dose of cefazolin 2 hours prior to incision. After surgery, is placed on cefazolin for 24 hours. This is an example of, and then you've got some choices. inappropriate antibiotic therapy, therapeutic antibiotic therapy, empiric antibiotic therapy, or prophylactic antibiotic therapy. This is where you need to be careful. This is where you need to know a little bit more about prophylaxis. So the skip measures say that prophylaxis must be given 1 hour before the incision or 2 hours if it's vancomycin. And the reason for the 2 hours is that vancomycin has to be run in over an hour time period. Otherwise, you put the patient at risk for Redman syndrome. So in this case, you want to look at the time period. This says cefazolin 2 hours prior to the incision. That's not going to be prophylaxis because it's not close enough to the time of incision. So in this case, the answer is inappropriate antibiotic therapy. If they changed this question, they said the patient is given a dose of cefazolin 1 hour prior to the incision, and he is placed on cefazolin for 48 hours after the surgery. Gee, that's not prophylaxis either, because the current recommendation is only 24 hours of therapy. So it's also inappropriate antibiotic therapy. So you really have to look at the question, not come up with the first, look carefully at what they're saying. They're going to try to stump you. 2 hours is not an appropriate time period. They expect an infection control practitioner to know that, who's got 2 years of experience. Another disease process that I took this straight out of communicable diseases in man, what you need to know from communicable diseases in man. So you need to know, for example, with chickenpox, motor transmission is direct contact, droplet, and airborne. You might get a question about that. What's the route of transmission in some quirky way? What's the usual incubation period? And this is where you want to stay with what is the usual. You can read 5 different references, and they may give you some variation. But most things in the APIC text says 10 to 21 days. Communicable diseases in man says 10 to 21 days. Period of communicability can be as long as 5 days, but the usual is 1 to 2 days. When you answer a question, you want to take that into account. What is the norm? You also want to know something about vaccination or prevention of these common diseases. For example, with varicella, you want to vaccinate susceptible individuals with 2 doses of varicella vaccine. It used to be 1 dose, and kids used to get 1 dose, and now the recommendation has changed to 2 doses. Because the exam was recently updated, you're going to be expected to know that information. So here's another possible test question. An employee calls on Tuesday morning because they're concerned that a patient they had cared for on Saturday night has developed a rash, and everyone is saying it looks like chickenpox. So the first thing you should be thinking of is, okay, they cared for them on Saturday, and now it's Tuesday. Saturday, count on your fingers. Saturday to Sunday is 1 day. Sunday to Monday is another day. Monday to Tuesday. Gee, that was 3 days before he developed the rash. Was he really exposed? So I'm already starting to think this through. He does not remember having chickenpox. What are we going to do about that? He has a pregnant wife at home and is concerned about giving her chickenpox. Basic information, you can't transmit chickenpox unless you have chickenpox to your family, or you are a terrible hand hygiene performer, or you rubbed up against this patient and got fluid from the vesicles on you, but you didn't have a rash on Tuesday morning. And the incubation period is 10 to 21 days, so you couldn't, even if you were not immune, you couldn't have developed chickenpox yet. So what are the best steps to be taken? And you have 4 choices. Have the employee go to employee health for an antibody test. Well, gee, he doesn't remember having chickenpox. This is a good thing for him to do anyway, because he should know if he's had chickenpox or not, so he doesn't go in a chickenpox room. So right there off the top, 1's on your list, because anybody who doesn't remember having chickenpox and is an employee in a healthcare facility should know if they've had chickenpox. So we've just said 1 is one of the right answers. Have the employee go to employee health for your immediate vaccination. Well, do you really need to go right away? He was exposed 3 days ago. 3 days ago, you're on the borderline of that vaccine working to prevent him from having infection. But we don't even know this patient has chickenpox yet. So maybe we need to get a little bit more information before we go on to do that. 3 is confirm that the patient has varicella. Always. In any situation where you are answering a test question about a diagnosis or a syndrome and confirm the patient has whatever they're asking about is an option, that is always going to be one of the right answers, because one of the basic steps in epidemiology is confirm what you are working with. Don't run out and do the investigation and then come back and find out, oh, they didn't really have the disease, so I did all that work for nothing. Confirm the diagnosis. So 3 is always going to be a correct answer. And then finally, tell the employee to have his wife notify her OB about the possible exposure. Well, we already talked about this. He can't give her chickenpox if he doesn't have it himself or if he hasn't been exposed to the vesicles. So in this case, there is no exposure of his wife, and what needs to be done is he needs to be reassured. So in this case, the correct answer is D. Have the employee go to employee health for antibody testing and confirm that the patient has varicella, because you may be doing a varicella exposure workup if he does. So those are some examples that you can use for studying and how to think about as you're reading the material, how am I going to use this? If you are practicing and you're meeting that practicing requirement, you already know what you've been asked for before, what challenges have come up. And as you're reading through the APIC text, use that information and think of how would this apply when you were in practice. So the next part is, what are your chances of passing the test? And this is from the CBIC News Winter Newsletter. About 70% of the first-time takers pass. And you should know in there are people who have come from foreign countries or are taking the exam and have language barriers, who have not practiced in an acute care setting, who really have not studied. What I will tell you is the majority of people who study and are English is their first language, and they have done that practice for 2 years as an infection control professional, will pass this test. You also need to look at the repeaters. The total number test in this case, 69, about half of them passed. What were the barriers there? You will be part of the majority, and that is the way to keep thinking about this. If you study and you practice your exam and you try to apply what you're reading to your everyday practice, you will pass this exam. I have absolutely no doubt, and you should have no doubt in your mind. So with that in mind, I added this slide, and it really, in my mind, is not an issue, because if you studied, you will pass. I can't say that often enough. It's not as hard as you think it is. But what do you do if you don't pass the test? Don't panic. All the results are confidential. If you are that nervous, like one of my ICPs was, that you don't think you're going to pass, you have any doubt about it, don't tell anybody you're taking the test. Pay for the test and get reimbursed when you pass. Go and have a relaxing day off the day before. Don't cram for it. You should already be ready. Maybe do a little brief review of those things. You know, you're not so sure about these organisms. Relax. Go in and take your exam. You will pass. If you don't pass, the results are between you and CBIC. Your boss doesn't need to know. Nobody else needs to know. Count it as a practice exam and move on and study what you were unsure of. Think about the test questions. Was it the way they were phrased? Try the CBIC online test study questions and go to the APIC certification study guide and do more test questions. Was the knowledge of what the content was, did you understand what they were asking for? If you didn't, restudy the APIC text, and I made a typo there, it shouldn't be restudy the APIC test, restudy the APIC test, and work with a more experienced ICP. Just make sure you understand those basic knowledge concepts that are in there and how you would use them, how you would apply them. In that case, if you've taken the test and you still haven't passed, you really want to talk to someone else who's certified, who's practiced for at least 5 years, who can help you through this is how you apply it. Where's the final word is the CBIC website, and this is just a picture of the CBIC website. Go to www.cbic.org. Most of what I've covered is from that site. The most important thing I can tell you about taking the exam is have confidence in yourself, study, know that you are, if you're qualified to take the test, you're doing something right, you're halfway there. read the APIC text through, read the communicable disease demand sections, you will do fine. And that's really it. I did leave my contact information. This is my work email. I do answer questions that people have about the certification exam, about general practice questions. There are also a number of listservs that you can get to through APIC, the APIC website, to sign up. Those are the day-to-day things that practitioners deal with every day, and will give you some further knowledge of how to apply what you've read. So if you have more questions, feel free to email me. I also left you my work number. I'm not as good about answering the phone as quickly, and probably email is your best bet. So thank you very much. I hope this was useful to you.
Sylvia, thank you very much. I think it was very useful. I learned quite a lot, and I sure appreciate your reinforcing that it's not as hard as we think, and that we're likely going to pass, if not the first time, certainly the second time.
Absolutely.
That calming voice of wisdom and experience is very, very helpful. Thanks for that. And you're very brave to leave your email and your phone information there. I would perhaps caution people on your behalf that Sylvia does have a full-time job. So if you could keep your questions brief, or if there's another source where you can get the information, perhaps try that as well or instead. But she's a font of wisdom, and I've certainly enjoyed working with her. So I thank you all for joining us today. I hope it's been very useful to you. It sure has been for me. And Sylvia, a very special thank you to you. You've done a stellar job, and I'm very, very grateful.
Thank you.
Until we talk again, everyone, goodbye.